I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the end of winter and the coming of spring, a time when many people's thoughts turn to working with the earth and helping to make things grow. We're going to talk about the science, art, and pleasures of gardening. My guest will be longtime reporter and gardening writer Joellen Meyer Sharp, Jeff Bollinger, a landscape architect with Fanning Howie, and Maggie Gegline of Fall Creek Gardens. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about spring gardening today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI and on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are my former colleague, friend, gardener and journalist Joellen Meyer Sharp. Joellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Jeff Bollinger, who is a landscape architect with Fanning Howie.
Great to be here.
It's good to have you. And Maggie Gegline with Fall Creek Gardens. Maggie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I got to start this show with a confession I've already made on Facebook, and that is that I know absolutely nothing about gardening. In fact, I kind of have a phobia about it. There may be some kind of learning block here. I say this both to my guests, saying that I'm not trying to insult you when I ask ignorant questions, but also to the audience to say if you're intimidated at the idea of calling in or doing something like that, this is the show for you because you cannot possibly be less informed than the host is today. So please call in with your questions. I'm going to ask a question. I mean, the kind of winter we've had where it's just been brutal and a lot of the ground is still frozen. I mean, what does that do to people who want to garden? What does it do to the timetable, the schedule? What challenges does it present? I'll start with you, Joellen.
It sort of slows things down a little bit. It's always good to wait until the soil is in a good enough state that you can work on it. If it's too wet, so if you can make a ball of soil and you sort of crush it with your hand, and if the dirt crumbles away, then you know you can work the soil. But if you make a ball and it stays as a ball, the soil is too wet. And when we work with soil that's too wet, it can destroy the structure of the soil, which is something that we take years and years to work on to build up so that we have good drainage and good aeration. And so it does sort of slow things down, but I've said for a long time that gardening teaches us patience because we can't really make things grow any faster or the trees get any bigger. And so this is just another way of being patient in the garden.
In terms of how has it affected the timetable? I mean, can people start working now? I mean, it's almost as if this is a harbinger here we've got a beautiful day on the day that we're talking about gardening.
Yes.
How many more of these days do you need, Jeff?
We're going to need quite a few more. In fact, I was just, you know, putting some trees into some pots this weekend, and you go down about 6 inches and you hit frost, and there was no end to it. And even in a mulch pile, which, you know, normally would heat up and keep that ice out, there's quite a bit of ice, and it's going to take quite some time for that to come out.
Yeah, someone told me that the frost level was like at about 28 inches or something like that, which is pretty deep.
And what, in terms of limiting the choices you can make in terms of gardening, what does that do, Maggie? Well,
you have to choose early spring crops that are going to do well in cooler temperatures. So you wouldn't want to
such
plant.
As some examples. Peas. I got to ask very basic questions.
Absolutely.
Here I don't get this stuff.
Peas, beets, radishes, some varieties of spinach and lettuce, some of the greens that do well in cooler temps. We're getting close to the time when we can probably start doing some seeding outside. Warmer weather plants, a lot of folks are starting inside if they want to start from seed, but it'll be mid-May at least before you probably want to send those plants outside to your garden.
We are talking about spring gardening here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Got a question that's come in from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. This is for Jeff. He says, we have a roughly 7-foot by 5-foot path leading from the patio into the yard with a large lilac tree and screened-in porch on either side. It is a high-traffic area for the dog. The grass is gone, and it's a mud bowl after rain. What's an idea for paving stones or something else to cover the mud and then fill in the odd-sized gaps near the tree and porch?
You mentioned about it is a wet area. One thing that you could look at would be some type of paving stone. We do a lot of projects where we look at actually porous paving where it does let the water flow through. So they might think about using some type of paver stone. And that can range from, you know, the normal bricks up to, you know, different types of stone paving. So I would probably look at that. And just the porosity between the, you know, the pieces will help absorb some of the water.
Porosity means how porous it is.
Yes, correct.
Okay, and just and on something like that, I mean, what would the cost involved be? Roughly,
it ranges from, you know, the type of material. If you're looking at some, you know, very exotic stone, it can, you know, be quite expensive. But, you know, on the low side, you're probably, you know, $10 a square foot or so for an installed type of paver, and depending on, you know, the contractor and so forth.
Is there other vegetation that you'd go between the stones, like moss or anything like that?
You can. It's, you know, you have to, if you want to look at moss, you have to actually culture moss. It'll start in an area, but you have to kind of help it along a little bit. So depends how tight the pavers are. If you've got a couple inches between, you can use something like that. And there are some types of ground cover. Some companies and nurseries will advertise those as steppables, which are, you know, kind of an indication that you can walk on those. But you have to be careful what you use in there because you could damage the plant.
We're talking about gardening here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning.
Morning or afternoon. What's on your mind?
I live in a modest high rise, I guess, mid rise, and I want to do a container on my patio. I've got straight east exposure, and I was wondering how much sunlight do I need to have success with some tomato plants?
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, John. Well, Maggie, I'll throw that one your way.
I would say 8 hours or more is preferable. You probably could get a nice plant with 6-7 hours. Any plant that you want to produce a fruit, so you want it to flower and then produce a fruit, is going to require more sunlight than something where you're just going to be harvesting greens, you know, lettuce leaves, things like that. Eastern light is good. Southern light is ideal. Northern light is going to be really tricky for most of those kind of fruit-bearing plants. So, you know, you can buy little cards at some garden stores that you can set out, and it can tell you how many hours of sunlight they absorb during a given day. You can also just kind of pay attention and watch and see how much light you're getting in an area. But for really healthy, happy tomato plants, they like as much sun as they can possibly get.
How much space do you need for various kinds of gardens? I mean, Joellen, I'll throw that. I mean, if let's suppose we've talked about what amounts to a balcony garden, right, here in an apartment. Suppose you're in a small house and you've got just a little bit of area in your yard, what can you do that would be satisfying there?
Well, first of all, you should grow only what you think you're going to eat. A lot, you know, just because you look at a book and it talks about growing okra, if you don't like okra, you don't have to grow okra. You can just grow tomatoes if you just want to grow tomatoes or peppers. In general,
what do you grow in yours?
I grow
potatoes. I presume you do have a garden.
I do have a garden. I'm actually transitioning from an in-ground garden to a growing process called Smart Pots, which are a recycled nylon fabric that are specially formulated to help retain moisture, improve root development, and grow. And I actually did these for the first time last year and doubled my potato harvest. And so I'm going to do tomatoes along with potatoes this year. But I usually grow what I like, which is I might grow a pepper plant or two. I grow maybe four or five tomatoes. I grow potatoes. I grow lettuces. And I have herbs. And all of those things you could grow on a patio, I think, or a balcony. Things that you need to keep in mind is the weight of the container that's going to be on the balcony. And that's more than just the soil and the plant. It's also the water that the pot holds. So you have to be mindful of that. But in general, for tomatoes and peppers, you want to leave roughly about 2 square feet. You could probably do it in a 1 square foot garden like the square foot gardener recommends. But for most of us, I think 2 square feet is probably a little bit more comfortable. So that would be, you know, just a square, 2-foot square. And you could grow really almost anything in that. And then you could underplant with lettuces if you wanted to, or underplant tomatoes with squash vines, something that would sort of fill in and not take up too much space. And then you can also do trellises, which is another way to actually get good food production without a lot of ground space.
What's the most common mistake people make when it comes to starting a garden? Maggie, I'll throw it to you. I mean, what things do you see?
I would say that sometimes you are wanting to just really jump in with both feet rather than maybe starting with a few items that you know your family loves to eat, and you want to learn all you can about growing them and then maybe next year expand into a larger space.
Don't do the entire North 40 the first
time.
Right.
And this time of year, we all want to get outside and do something, and the idea of fresh food being available after, you know, a cold winter, I think it's very easy to bite off a little more than you can chew, kind of figuratively at least, when you're getting started with a garden. In our community garden, we start the basic unit is 4 feet by 4 feet, which is not a big space for a gardener that has a lot of things they want to grow, but is...
How much does that produce? I mean, I should have asked that when Joellen was talking to. How much, you know, in Joellen, in your case, I mean, in terms of the potatoes, yeah, I mean, is it enough for a single meal or enough to feed a family of five for a year?
No.
Okay.
It wouldn't keep a family.
I'm trying to give you a range here.
It wouldn't keep a family of five for a year. It would, I mean, potatoes store fairly easily, so you could probably get a couple of months after what I had. So I had 2 pots growing, 2 different types of potatoes, and I probably had a couple of months worth of potatoes there. But I'm going to say in a, like, closer to like a 4x6 flat or maybe a 4x10, you get about 160 pounds of food, roughly. A lot depends on what crops you grow there. Mm-hmm. If you're only growing tomatoes, you know, you might get a little bit more. But if you're growing tomatoes and green beans, you know, they don't weigh exactly the same. And so... Mm-hmm. And I would say the other mistake that people make is they don't pay attention to the soil. Maggie's right in that they start too big. They try to, like, turn their whole backyard into a big vegetable garden and then don't realize how much work it is, for one thing, and, you know, how much attention and time it might take, how much resources, how much water it's going to take. You know, paying attention to the soil, working on the soil, adding organic matter to the soil on a regular basis is probably the most important thing you can do, I think.
Jeff, we've gotten a question, a follow-up on your answer. Somebody wanted to know what steppable means.
And you might see it in some of the you know, big stores. They'll advertise, and it's a kind of a brand.
Yeah.
Label, and it's labeled as steppable, which means that those plants can tolerate some minimal, you know, foot traffic over them, and you know, they are really recommended for that use.
So it means you can walk on them, you can't stomp on them.
Right, exactly.
Basically,
right.
That's
exactly.
It. You
but
can't
some
jump
plants
up
are like thyme is yes. one plant.
Is
some
one.
Of the low-growing sedums.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mazus. I mean, there are lots of little low, they're usually low-growing plants that can tolerate some foot traffic.
We are talking about spring gardening here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI, and Twitter is WFYI. My guests are Joellen Meyer-Sharp, gardener and journalist, Jeff Bollinger, landscape architect with Fanning Howey, and Maggie Gegline of Fall Creek Gardens. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about spring gardening today on No Limits. My guests are Joellen Meyer-Sharp, gardener, journalist, former colleague at the Indianapolis Star, Jeff Bollinger, who's a landscape architect with Fanning Howey, and Maggie Gegline with Fall Creek Gardens. Again, we are talking about spring gardening. Getty, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a question for any one of you, I suppose. I am wanting to put together raised beds this season, and it's my first time doing it. And I was just wondering a couple things. One, because it's so cold out, and I'm not sure when the last frost would be, when would be a good time to start putting the raised beds together? And then also, I kind of have an uneven surface. So I'm wondering if there's a way to sink them to the ground so that when it rains, all of the soil doesn't just wash out of it.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Well, Maggie, I'm going to throw one in on top of that, too. We probably ought to define what a raised bed is, too,
sure.
in the process.
A raised bed is any garden plot where you are not actually tilling into the soil, but you're either mounding additional soil up on top or building a structure that you then fill with soil or compost. So it's above ground gardening. And you might choose to build raised beds for a variety of reasons. In urban areas, a lot of times there's a lot of lead left over from lead-based paint and lead-based gas back in the day. You might want to be building a raised bed and gardening above ground to make sure that your soil quality is what you want it to be. Raised beds also drain a little better. They tend to warm up faster in the spring because they're above the ground. Mm-hmm. So all of those can be benefits to gardening in raised beds. I would say that you could get started building your bed at any time. I think that in my experience, soil that's had a chance to kind of settle in and all of those organisms have a chance to kind of get used to their surroundings, it's going to just be a little better for your garden in the long run that way. So I would say start plotting out where you want to put your beds right now. It's nice, too, because you can put down some newspaper or cardboard or landscape cloth before the grass and the weeds even start really sprouting substantially for the spring, and you can kind of start smothering that all out before they have a chance to get going. As far as evening out your soil, it would be good to kind of dig in and try and level out where you are building, where you're going to put the beds, because if you have any gaps along the bottom, you're going to lose a lot of that soil that you've been building so, you know, painstakingly right out from underneath. You could also line it with landscaping cloth, and that would kind of create like a little seal along the bottom to keep most of your soil in place. I would suggest just kind of digging out the area that is higher and even using a level to try and make sure that you're getting a good solid foundation for whatever you choose to use as the structure of your bed. You can use lumber, you can use stone, you can use, oh my goodness, all kinds of things. People recycle mm-hmm. old tires and use those as garden spots, so you can really use a wide range.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Michelle who says, we are just finishing building a new house. And I should say, if you want to join the conversation by email, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Says that the yard is medium-sized. What are some good plants, shrubs, plants, flowers to start with, new flower beds that will go in the soil where is best place to start? I'll throw that one to the landscape architect. That sounds like that's in your wheelhouse, Jeff.
Well, a lot of it depends on what exposures you have. You know, if it's a home that's built in, you know, in a very shaded area, that brings into play a whole different palette of plants. You get into, you know, hostas, azaleas, rhododendrons. If you're looking at, you know, a subdivision that's been put in, you know, basically into a field, and it's, you know, a lot of sunlight, and in that case, you may have some real soil issues because, you know, a lot of times the topsoil isn't near what it was when it was a farm field. So, and I'm assuming maybe that this is, you know, a very open condition that you're talking about. So I would stick with the very hardy things. Over time, if you create some of those microclimates that you can create shade, you could maybe do some of the shade plantings. But in general, I would probably look at very hardy things that would tolerate a lot of sun, and especially this year would tolerate very low temperatures too. This has been an exceptional winter.
We've also gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, said, does the clay-like soil in Indianapolis make gardening difficult, which I think is in line
with where we're at.
Do gardeners have to buy soil from gardening centers, or is it possible to garden in our yard without purchasing additives?
The organic matter in the soil, that is very critical to help, you know, create microorganisms and a, you know, a good condition there. It just helps in porosity of the soil. Our clays here in central Indiana, they are very hard to garden in. Northern Indiana, where you have sands, you can grow about anything. But these clays are a challenge. And the question earlier about the raised beds, you're able to basically create your own soil type and create a very good soil environment.
To get some of the clay out of it.
Yes, correct.
And that helps.
Well, with raised beds, you usually bring in bulk planter's mix or something like that to fill the raised bed.
We are talking about spring gardening here on No Limits. To join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Hello?
David, yes, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Hey, I had a quick question, and thanks for taking my call. Concerning deer, actually I have two questions. The deer savaged my garden last year. It's a community garden over by Eagle Creek Park on the west side of Indianapolis. And I was wondering if there are flowers or herbs or somebody told me even human hair would keep deer away. The second question is, our development participates in a like an islet development, an island where we're supposed to submit a plan to, you know, beautify that islet, but it gets a lot of traffic in the afternoon and in the morning for rush hour. And I was just wondering, and it's pretty small, I was wondering what plants would be best for that situation, because there's a lot of just standing traffic at the four-way stop. So that's my question. I'll take my answer off the air.
Great. Thanks very much for the call, David. Well, Joellen, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, deer are definitely a problem, I think, for gardeners, especially out by Eagle Creek, where they just seem to, you know, set up housekeeping along with everyone else out there. Unfortunately, there aren't really any plants or herbs or, you know, human hair that you can use that will consistently repel the deers. There are repellents that you can buy at garden centers, which smell really gross. They're made out of rotten eggs, maybe, or the urine of a coyote. We actually have a veterinarian and a manufacturer in southern Indiana that makes a product called Wireless Deer Fence, and they have pheromones in the tips of these 18-inch tall rods that you can set in your garden about 25 feet apart. And the pheromones attract the deer. They get there and they get a slight little shock on their nose, sort of the old operant conditioning kind of, and it sets them on a different pathway. And I know several people who've used these, who swear by these. You can replace the pheromone every year. There are some plants that are more resistant than others, but they're not usually edible plants. They're more like hellebores or some of the hollies and different things like that. As far as the island goes, I would probably stick with drought-tolerant plants. I'd look at the list of native plants that might be available, some of the native grasses. All of those are sort of, grown up here in the state and are better able to withstand some of the environmental conditions that a traffic island might present.
We've also gotten a question from a listener via Facebook, and if you want to do that, you can find us at No Limits WFYI on Facebook. This is from Kristen, who says, last year we bought a house with several shrubs. A few of them are overgrown. I have quite a bit of experience trimming bushes, but I am not sure how far I can take them down. We have boxwood, juniper, and yew. Who wants that one? I'll throw that one, I guess, to Jeff, since Maggie and Joellen are throwing you under the bus on it. So,
well, it depending again on the plant, some of your shrubs, some of your spireas, you're able to basically trim those off at the ground level, and they will flush completely back up. If you're getting into the yews and junipers, you can do some pruning, but. And I mean, you can get pretty extensive with it, but it's going to look, pretty disheveled for several years. So you have to kind of moderate that a little bit. And most of your deciduous shrubs that grow very fast, you're able to do a lot of pruning on those and take those down and be merciless on them because they will sprout back. But your yews, your junipers, you have to be a little bit more moderate on those.
I think the lesson is also, right. Which I know they inherited the property,
yeah.
But it's knowing the mature size of the plant is very helpful in making your decisions on what you're going to put in your landscape.
And how would you go to find that out?
It's usually on the plant tag. Sometimes you might have to do a little bit more research, but if you know that you're going to put this plant along what I call like the shrub zone, which is, the shrub area around the house, and that plant's going to get 6 feet tall and 6 feet wide, you know that you need at least 3.5 feet or 4 feet from the house in order to have that plant be its mature size. It's not just going to grow 6 feet one way. It's going to grow 6 feet wide all around.
Well, and how would you, though, in this case, if somebody else screws that up and you bought the house and it's overgrown, you don't have a plant tag that tells you that. How do you go to find it out?
Well, if it's already overgrown, you could do rejuvenation pruning, possibly. So if they go to Google and type in Purdue rejuvenation pruning, they'll get a decent little brochure that tells them about that. But at some point...
Go ahead and give them that URL again.
Oh, it would just be going to Google and typing in Purdue rejuvenation pruning.
Okay.
And so it'll call out that document. But at some point, I usually tell folks that they just might want to think about replacing the plants that are there over time. They don't have to do it all at once, but the one that demands the most maintenance might be the first one that would go.
We are talking about spring gardening here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Well, we've got a caller named Joellen. Hello, Joellen. And a guest named Joellen. So, caller Joellen, what's on your mind?
I have a question about in the spring, I put 12-12-12 on my perennials. Can I do that this afternoon, even if it's as cold as it is?
Well, we'll try to find out. First, I'm going to try to find out what 12-12-12 means.
So the 12-12-12 basically refers to the fertilizer components, the first number being the nitrogen content, 12% nitrogen, the second one being phosphorus, the third being potassium. And you really could go out there today and put it down. It's going to leach into the soil a little bit. You wouldn't want to put it on necessarily in the fall because by spring it would have leached out. But now would be a good time for that, as well as doing some initial seeding. I mean, you can do any of that from now on.
And what sort of weed prevention would you recommend?
If you were going to do any seeding work, I would hold off on doing the weed prevention. But if your lawn is pretty decent and you're just looking at trying to control the weeds, now would be a good time to put down, some type of preventative. And that would go for landscape beds as well. Get that down before that it does have a chance to warm up enough to where your weeds are going to start to germinate. So
right. If it's a pre-emergent, they say when the forsythia bloom is a good time to apply a pre-emergent, which keeps weed seeds from sprouting. It does not kill existing weeds.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Shannon, and if you'd like to find us on Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. It says, a bird thoughtfully planted a wild grape in my huge lilac. What can I do to eradicate it? The vine overtakes the lilac. Maggie, I'll throw that one your way.
Well, if you can kind of go down through the tangle vine until you find where it's actually emerging from the soil, you could just cut it off right at ground level with a pair of garden loppers or pruners. And then it depends on if you want to do things from an organic standpoint or if you want to use chemical herbicides to kill the plant. You know, if you have trouble where it's sprouting back up from that root and just lopping it off didn't do the trick. The organic method would be probably to continue lopping it off as it keeps growing up and to just come back and be consistent with it. This is my preference personally, but I have honeysuckle all over my yard at home, and it is an exercise in diligence.
And staying ahead of it is tricky. We've gotten a question from a listener named Toby who did not want to go on the air, who says he's trying to develop a compost pile with compost bags, and it's just turning into rotten trash. Any advice? Joellen or Maggie?
I'm not sure what you mean by compost bags. But if you're using bags of compost to make the compost pile and leaving it in the bags, it probably would become anaerobic. After time, you would want to dump it out of the bags and put it in a pile and sort of churn that pile. But a compost pile is really made up of debris from the yard, like leaves and grass clippings and things like that, that have time over time that just break down and become this really wonderful soil amendment.
So walk us through the process then real quickly of how you should do compost properly. What should go in it and what shouldn't?
Well, the things that shouldn't go in it are meat products and dairy products, oils, you know, things like that from the kitchen. But most kitchen scraps can go in a compost pile, leaves, grass clippings, weeds that you're pulling from the garden. You want to keep the compost pile in an area that, you know, has some sun to it. It also needs a little bit of moisture in order to what they call cook, so it just heats up. Churning it with a garden fork is one way to speed up that process. But you can do a lazy man compost pile, which is pretty much what I do, which is just sort of like load everything onto a pile and let it sit there all year and then churn it up in the spring and use whatever I can out of that. It's, you know, you in a city, you might want to think about whether you want to put kitchen scraps in the compost pile. You might just want to go with straight yard debris because it can attract unwanted critters like rodents.
We have gotten a question via Facebook, and you can find us at No Limits WFYI on Facebook, from a listener named Rachel, who we dealt with the first part of her question because she wanted you to talk about composting. And she refers to you, by the way, as our wonderful guest. So she's clearly impressed with what you're saying. And she says, also, have they heard of Wallapini greenhouses? I have not heard. How about that? Maggie is nodding her head. So please tell me what a Wallapini greenhouse is. Did I pronounce that right?
I believe so. I am not an expert on the pronunciation, and I am certainly not an expert on the concept, but I have admittedly been kind of daydreaming about one myself. The idea is that if you consider a greenhouse above ground, a normal greenhouse, you have you know, the sides and the roof of the greenhouse. One of the Wallapini greenhouses are built down into the soil so that the walls and flooring of the greenhouse are actually kind of underground, and you just have the A-frame or whatever shape of the roof above ground. And the idea is it kind of is like a combination almost of a root cellar with some temperature and climate control that being encased in the soil is going to give you, with all of the solar radiation heat coming in from a clear roof. So rather than losing all that heat out of the sidewalls, you're actually keeping it kind of in the space a little better.
We are talking about spring gardening here on No Limits. My guests are Joellen Meyer Sharp, gardener and journalist, Jeff Bollinger, landscape architect with Fanning Howie, and Maggie Gegline of Fall Creek Gardens. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about spring gardening today. My guests are Joellen Myers-Sharp, gardener and journalist, Jeff Bollinger, landscape architect with Fanning Howey, and Maggie Gegline of Fall Creek Gardens. We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Bree, who says, do your guests recommend actually testing the soil for fertility, and how can one do this? That would be Maggie.
I think that's a great tool for knowing what you might need to add to your soil, what you might be having in overabundance, and it's definitely a great resource for kind of knowing the playing field before you get going in the spring. This would be a good time to do that too. So there are a couple of different places that you can go. There's A&L Laboratories up in Fort Wayne, which is, I think, one of the go-to laboratories for this. And you can Google them and find out more specific instructions on their site.
My name is again real quickly.
A&L Great Lakes Laboratories.
Okay.
In Fort Wayne.
Okay.
But basically what you do is you take samples from the area that you're interested in learning about, and you can specify, you know, I'm going to use this for vegetable gardening. I'm going to use this as a just foundation planting around my house for non-edibles, you know, kind of give them a little extra information about your intended purpose. And then you send your soil samples off to the lab and pay, it's either $15 or $20. And then they will return it to you within several business days with a full rundown of what is existing in your soil, and usually some good recommendations for what you might want to add.
We've also gotten a question from a listener named Steve from Shelbyville, who did not want to go on the air. Says, want some advice on how to get rid of fungus in a garden, killing grapes, tomatoes, etc. Joellen?
Well, that is a problem. The first thing I'd look at is what kind of air circulation the plants might have. The other thing I would probably look at is when I'm actually maybe watering or irrigating those plants. If you've got a problem of fungus in the garden, you'd want to water early in the morning so that things are not staying wet all day long. There are some organic fungicides that you can use for those crops. You always want to read and follow the label directions, because fungicides are particularly deadly to bees, and we want to make sure that we're using them in an appropriate way to control those. But they're like copper-based fungicides, which is probably the most broadly used one, I think, that's considered an organic one. But even though it's organic, it'll still kill bees.
We are talking about spring gardening here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please do so by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a question about compost piles. I have had a compost pile for many years. It's near a fence. I put mostly dead leaves in it, but other things occasionally too. And I have a problem with weeds growing up into the compost pile. It is near a fence, so it may be a placement issue, but that's the convenient place for me to have my compost pile. Is there any way that I can get rid of the roots or not have them grow up so much?
Maggie, thanks very much for the call, Gary.
I think that there's always going to be a tendency, you know, what you're building is really a great amendment for your soil. And so any seeds in there are going to find this as ideal conditions for sprouting. So you kind of are working at cross purposes a little bit. But I would say turning your compost more frequently is going to help destroy the plants and the root systems, hopefully. You could also, I suppose, if you wanted to kind of move to a new spot for a little bit, you could put down some kind of landscaping cloth or barrier cardboard. Underneath, cardboard, newspaper really thickly, anything that's going to take quite a while to break down and is going to really kind of cap the soil where the weed seeds are coming from. You also want to make sure what you're adding to the compost pile isn't adding a bunch of weed seeds. So if you are taking weeds out of the yard or the garden, make sure that you only add them to the compost pile if they haven't formed seed heads yet. Mm-hmm. And that way you're not kind of planting them
on
accident.
And I'll ask a basic ignorant question. How do you know that they have formed seed heads?
You would need to look for it on the plant. So if you have seen a flower stalk come up and then there is, you know, the dried remains of a flower head is usually a good indicator that there are seeds formed there.
It also tells me that his compost pile may not be hot enough. I mean, because the heat of the compost pile destroys weed seeds. Mm-hmm. And so churning it would help, you know, heat that up a little bit, putting in a little bit of rotted manure or another little bit of compost in there will also help heat that up.
He might also cover that with a dark visqueen that would really raise that temperature up.
What dark visqueen? What is a
black plastic bag.
Oh, okay.
Just a continuous cover over top of that pile, and that's going to help raise that temperature too to cook those weed seeds and plants.
Okay. We've gotten a question via email from a listener named Dee who says, we want to start a vegetable garden this year. We have a large field in our backyard with full sun that we have just been mowing. What's the best way to remove the sod? I have heard negative comments on just tilling under the sod or using a sod cutter. We don't have the manpower to build raised beds. Any other thoughts?
I'd go with a sod cutter.
Mm-hmm. You'd go with a sod cutter?
You can rent those at hardware stores, and they do a pretty nice job of getting rid of that.
If you catch it early enough, right now, you know, you might mow that down very short and get rid of a lot of that. And at times then you might be able to just go ahead and till it. But otherwise, you know, I would probably remove the sod. But you might try this first.
We've gotten another email question from a listener named John who says, when can I start to rake up thatch and start to aerate and overseed in my yard?
Now.
You can rake the lawn now. I probably would look at seeding in April maybe. You know, you don't want to put down a pre-emergent if you're going to do grass seed. Aeration you can do anytime. In spring or, again, in September is actually probably the prime time to do soil or aeration.
We are talking about spring gardening here on No Limits. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello there. I have a question about using corn gluten meal for weed prevention. I have pretty good success in the spring, but in the later months and in the fall, the dandelions come back. It really doesn't do much for clover, which doesn't bother me. But what's your advice on using corn gluten meal for weed prevention?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Jeff. Joellen.
Well, I use corn gluten as a pre-emergent weed control. And usually you need to do it, I'd say, 3 times a year. It's going to last. You could start now or when the forsythia blooms. And then, again, maybe 6 weeks later. And then you could do a third application in late August, early September to help control some of the winter annual weeds that we're going to get. It does not kill – a pre-emergent herbicide does not kill existing weeds. It only keeps weed seeds from sprouting. So if you have existing dandelions in your lawn, it's not going to do anything for the dandelions in your lawn.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Karen who says, can you please explain the reasons for not doing volcano mulching? First, I'd like to know what volcano mulching is. Jeff, you're laughing, so I'm going to throw that one your way.
We see that a lot, and I know there's a tendency in the spring to go out and remulch around those trees, and it basically, you know, if you don't give it enough time for that mulch to break down and you come back the next year and the next year and you just create this, like she says, a mulch volcano around the tree, it's not good for the tree. It does create a zone, a wet zone around the base of that tree. It doesn't give the base of the tree a chance to dry out, and it just brings in pests and it causes some issues for the tree growth.
I've gotten a tweet from a listener named Dan who says that we should remind people when fertilizing lawn to use recommended amounts. Too much fertilizer is bad for lawn, water, and environment. How big a problem is that? I mean, do we see people using too much of this stuff?
There's a tendency, I think, to over-fertilize. And as you may notice, as you go into the stores this spring, in fact, a lot of the companies are leaving out the phosphorus out of that middle number. Like you get a 12-12-12, that middle number would be the 6% of phosphorus, and that's the biggest component that is the problem, especially with Eagle Creek. You know, where municipal water comes from, it creates those algae blooms, and down in Florida, so that's the biggest problem. And people have a tendency to over fertilize at times.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Grady who says, "I need tips on large ornamental grasses, sunlight, water, and tips."
Well, most ornamental grasses do best in full sun, which would be 6 or more hours of sun a day. Usually we cut them back around this time of the year because part of the pleasure of having an ornamental grass is the interest they provide in the winter garden. Most of them are very drought tolerant. There are a few. The wild oak grass is one that can tolerate some shade. Some of the carexes also can tolerate shade. So you want to look at the area that you're trying to plant and select plants that are going to do well for that spot.
Bart, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm calling about crabgrass. I put down a pre-emergent every spring about this time. It seems to control it. It seems to control it well. But the last few years in the dry summer, the crabgrass tends to come back, and sometimes with a vengeance. What, if anything, can be done about that?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Bart. Well, I'll throw that one to Maggie.
Actually, I am a person with a lawn that is full of all kinds of things that the caller probably wouldn't want in his lawn, so I would pass the baton to someone else. I'm known to cultivate a few weeds in my lawn, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. I think part of the problem is the last few years is the drought has opened up the lawn for weeds are extremely opportunistic, so if they've got a spot, they're going to go.
They're like most the politicians.
They are, and most
world.
Of what consumers can buy only has a window of working for about 90 days. So once you've exceeded that 90 days and there are other weed seeds in the lawn area, it's possible you're going to get a reinfestation. To me, the best thing to do is to keep your lawn thick and healthy, which is having it on a good maintenance program, mow high, 3 inches tall. Apply a fall fertilizer in September and November. Those are the two key times to fertilize the lawn. A thick, healthy lawn is the best defense we've got about controlling weeds in the lawn.
One of the things, the droughts we've had, a lot of people will want to use a Kentucky bluegrass, and we're finding with the droughts that one is suffering quite a bit. So maybe switching the grass to more of fescues, that right. type of thing would help. And again, keeping that lawn, that turf very thick.
Deb, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, this is along the same lines as some other callers. We seeded our backyard. It was just dirt, and we seeded it about a year and a half ago during the drought, and it didn't stick. So we seeded again last summer, and we aerated last fall, and it's very patchy. We also have a 220-pound English Mastiff that goes potty in our backyard. And I was wondering, what advice do you have to get it to stick? We now have a sprinkler system, and should we seed again here in the spring, and how often should we run the sprinklers, and do we need to keep our dog out of the backyard?
Jeff,
definitely
Jeff,
keep the
thanks.
Dog out of the backyard, or if you can confine him to one area, because that will have a real impact on it. Putting in the irrigation will help quite a bit. A lot of times, it's especially in homes that are just built, the topsoil is a little deficient, and so I think aerating, bringing in some organic material, overseeding and constantly overseeding, in the fall would be the best time to really push it and fertilize it and try that in the fall. We're coming into the second best season, which is the spring, so I'd really concentrate and keep the dog maybe in a confined
right.
area if you could.
You might be able to rent a device called a slit seeder, which makes slits in the in the ground, and then it deposits seeds in that area, and it gives a really good concentration, I think, of lawn seed in the lawn. But just like Jeff said, the prime time is, you know, late summer, early fall for sowing the seeds. So even though you sow it in the spring, you might want to do it again in the fall.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Dana who says, I have a large area in my front yard of overgrown periwinkle, English ivy, some poison ivy, and other weeds. I'd like to do a start over in the area with new ground cover plants. It's a fairly large area, so using a shovel to break up the vines would be rather labor intensive. Any suggestion on an eco-friendly herbicides, you know, vinegar solution, etc., to kill what's there?
You know, I have been there with the shovel, so I totally understand. The folks that owned our house before us seemed to stick euonymus or vinca or whatever they could that was going to take over in every conceivable spot in the yard. One thing that I have read about, I've not tried it, but I've heard that you can really kind of scorch the area by putting down a clear plastic. There's an official term for that, but basically you're kind of doing the same sort of smothering that you might do with black plastic that's going to attract heat. But with a clear plastic, there may be the capacity to kind of have a greenhouse effect and really fry those plants. I don't know if that's going to keep things from coming back, though. You know, that's probably going to kind of clear out your ground area, but I don't know, Joellen, do you have other recommendations?
Well, it took a long time for those plants to be there. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and to do it in an environmentally friendly way, it's basically digging them out, trying to smother them or fry them, just like Maggie suggested, and just staying on top of it. It's not an easy solution. And the plants that you mentioned, the vinca and the euonymus, are on the Indiana State's invasive species list, so it's good that you're thinking about getting rid of those.
We've got time for one more quick question. This is from a listener named Becky, who says, I want to share my daffodils with a friend. When should the bulbs be removed from the ground? How should they be stored? And when should they be replanted? Joellen, I'm going to throw that one to you, and you got about 20 seconds.
Right. I would wait until after they've bloomed and start to die back, and I would dig them then, and I would transplant them immediately after that.
Well, this has been interesting. I can safely say I learned a lot, but then I was starting pretty much from zero. I would like to thank my guest, Joellen Meyer-Sharp, gardener and journalist. Joellen, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, John.
Jeff Bollinger, who is a landscape architect with Fanning Howie. Jeff, thank you very much for joining us. And Maggie Gegline. I got that right every time.
Yep.
Fall Creek Gardens.
Thank you for
being here. This was fun. I enjoyed talking with all of you. We will be back on Thursday. I am John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.